From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Ross Reynolds. This is The Conversation. Glenn Greenwald is a former constitutional lawyer turned columnist on civil liberties and U.S. national security. Up until this year, he was a contributing writer at Salon. Now he's writing for The Guardian. His books include A Tragic Legacy, which looks at the Bush legacy, and With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Glenn Greenwald also tweets at G. Greenwald. He has over 100,000 followers there. Glenn, thanks so much for coming in today. I really appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
So you've written of Tuesday's election. It was not merely Democrats, but liberalism, which was triumphant. Why?
Well, I think that if you look at the kinds of candidates who won, for example, who were sent to the Senate, people like Elizabeth Warren in Massachusetts, Tammy Baldwin in a fairly purple state in Wisconsin, who became the first openly gay person to be elected to the U.S. Senate, these are people who are on the progressive edge of the Democratic Party that you could even call very liberal or leftist, which is unusual. And at the same time, you have ballot measures not just in blue states like Washington or Maryland, but also in states that are more purple like Wisconsin. Minnesota and Maine that passed marriage equality, something that even 4 years ago was considered fairly radical. The same with marijuana legalization. And so you see this and then on top of that, you see this demographic shift in the electorate to people who clearly are behind progressivism and rejecting the far right mentality that has prevailed in this country for at least a decade. And I think it's a pretty momentous shift.
But meanwhile, at the top of the ticket, President Barack Obama, you've been very critical of their policy on drone strikes, on the execution of U.S. citizens without due process, on the treatment of Bradley Manning, the soldier who gave WikiLeaks all those documents. But you still see liberalism as being triumphant?
Well, I don't think that Obama's reelection is evidence of the triumph of liberalism's triumphant. Ironically, I think one of the things you're about to see in the next week or so is President Obama once again making efforts, for example, to cut Social Security and Medicare, the sort of crown jewels of American liberalism, as part of his pursuit of a grand bargain with the Republican Party. And so the reason I wrote that column was not to be triumphalist about the rise of liberalism as a result of the Obama presidency, but to essentially say that liberals have more power politically than they've had before and ought to use that to hold President Obama accountable and prevent him from doing the sorts of things he's been doing in the first term that are so contrary to the political platform of American liberals.
And yet you're foreseeing what you call a standard pattern of self-disempowerment by the liberals. What do you mean by that? How do you see it playing out?
Well, if you look at some of the issues that you mentioned regarding national security and civil liberties, as well as the extension of the Bush tax cuts and his attempts to cut those entitlement programs in the first term, you see this familiar pattern where liberals begin. You saw this especially in the healthcare fight, where liberals said we will never support any bill that doesn't have a public option. And instead, the ultimate bill that mandated that everybody buy products from the private health insurance industry was one that liberals almost unanimously supported despite those pledges. So you see this pattern where they say we will never accept any bill or any program that violates our core principles in this way. And then they slowly start to become good partisan soldiers getting on board. And that's the reason nobody takes seriously the threats of progressives not to support a particular policy if it ends up too contrary or too much of an abandonment of what they believe. They know that liberals will get in line as partisan loyalists at the end, and that is what's so disempowering.
Glenn Greenwald, did the issues that are important to you that you've written about a lot, civil liberties, have anything to do in this election race? I don't recall questions being asked at any of the debates. It did not appear as though Barack Obama paid any price for being on what you would say is the wrong side of those issues.
No, I mean, the principal reason why that was so was because there were no differences between him and Mitt Romney on these issues. There's lots of people who like to say in the pundit class, even American progressives, that Republicans refuse to compliment President Obama or agree with him. Actually, the reverse is really quite true. With regard to these controversial policies of militarism, drone use, civil liberties abridgment, Republicans have become his biggest fans. And one of the only times that this issue was raised in the debates, for example, is when Mitt Romney in the third debate, the one on foreign policy, was asked about his views of President Obama's use of drones, which has continuously killed Muslim children and other innocent men and women in that part of the world with no accountability, no transparency. And Mitt Romney said, I agree entirely that the president is doing the right thing. I wholeheartedly support what he's doing. And when there's no disagreement between the two parties on a certain issue, as there so often isn't, that issue gets taken off the table in terms of what gets attention from the establishment media. And that's why these issues played so little role in the American election.
But sometimes when there's an issue that the public is incensed about, you'll see a small party candidate, maybe a Green Party candidate, or I don't know, Gary Johnson from the Libertarian Party was saying, it didn't seem to catch much fire anywhere.
Well, Well, Gary Johnson did get in excess of 1% of the vote, which is the most that any Libertarian Party candidate has received in several decades, and he really focused on those issues. But I think that, you know, even the liberals who are upset with President Obama about these policies, the continuation of the Bush-Cheney civil liberties assault, counterterrorism, radicalism, were so swayed by the very successful demonization campaign against the Republican Party. Fear-mongering is a very potent force. It's what keeps Republicans in line and voting for people like Mitt Romney and John McCain, even though they think they're not the ideal conservative candidates, the scary American liberals who want to destroy the country. Very much that is how the Democratic Party keeps liberals in line, by saying you may be disenchanted with President Obama in these ways, but there's this other evil that's far more menacing, and you need to set aside whatever your dissatisfaction is with President Obama and get in line behind him, and that works.
If you just joined us, Glenn Greenwald is my guest. You may have written what he's had to say about civil liberties at Salon. He's writing for The Guardian now. We're at 206-543-5869. That's 206-543-KUOW. If you're outside the area, it's 800-289-5869, or write to us. It's conversation at KUOW.org. In a recent column that you wrote was headlined, "Who was the worst civil liberties president in history?" And you noted a recent Washington Post report that the Obama administration is creating permanent bureaucratic systems to implement its war on terror powers, adding names or to kill or capture lists for many, many years to come. So where do you think the Obama administration's ranking is in that question?
Right. Well, it's interesting. Obviously, prior presidents have abridged civil liberties in pretty extreme ways, including ones that tend to be viewed as good presidents. Franklin Roosevelt obviously interned hundreds of thousands of Japanese American citizens during World War II. Abraham Lincoln suspended habeas corpus. Woodrow Wilson and John Adams both attacked free speech in the name of war and tried to imprison dissidents. But what I think distinguishes President Obama's civil liberties assault, or sort of the Bush-Obama civil liberties assault in the name of the war on terror, that makes it somewhat worse, are two factors. One is what you just indicated, which is that unlike those other civil liberties abridgments that were designed to be temporary and that ended when the war that justified them ended, what is happening now is the permanent institutionalization of these very radical powers, of the ability of the president to order imprisoned or killed anybody he wants in total secrecy with no due process, because this quote-unquote war on terror is one that by its nature can and will never end. And the Obama administration itself says it's definite to go on at least another decade. It's already been a decade. So you're talking about a permanent transformation of the American political system in the way in which the president is empowered to act. And the other thing that distinguishes it and that makes it worse is that unlike Lincoln, who really did face a war that was a genuine existential threat to the United States, or Franklin Roosevelt, who faced a massive conflagration in the war in the world, the quote-unquote war on terror is really not much of a war at all. Americans are more likely to die by slipping in a bathtub or by being struck by lightning than they are by terrorism. This is a threat that has been wildly exaggerated. And so if you compare the supposed threat that these civil liberties abridgments are designed to solve, I think in that regard, too, President Obama and his predecessor, President Bush, look much worse than other presidents.
Is this the Barack Obama you expected in 2008?
Well, interesting. I gave a speech to the ACLU of Massachusetts 2 months after President Obama was inaugurated, saying that I know that it seems as though this sort of civil liberties nirvana has descended upon us because we have this constitutional law scholar and professor who's progressive who has now been elected. But the reality is that many of these problems are institutional. They're systemic. And you have to basically count on President Obama being willing to sacrifice his own political fortune and have a great deal of political courage to stand up to what Dwight Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex, a sort of permanent national security state. And it, I think, was very unlikely that he was going to do so. The history of his life is sort of one of accommodating status quo institutions and prevailing power structures rather than challenging and subverting them in a meaningful way. And so I don't think it was surprising in general that he's been disappointing in these areas. I do think it's surprising the extent to which he's not only continued many of these policies, but in many senses gone beyond what Bush and Cheney even did. That I do think is surprising.
Barack Obama, a constitutional lawyer. You, a constitutional lawyer. I bet in some corner of your mind you've run through the conversation you would have with him about constitutional law if you had the chance, or maybe you have had the chance.
Well, I mean, I've spoken to lots of senior Obama officials, never to the president, about any of these issues.
And if you got a chance to do that, what would your opening foray be with him?
Well, I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things that happens historically, and this is a psychological, sociological phenomenon, is that once someone gets into power, they stop seeing the need for checks and for transparency and due process and the like, because they view themselves as essentially a good person, a good leader. And therefore, somebody somebody who can be trusted with these powers, who will not use them for malevolent ends. The problem, though, is that a president who institutionalizes these powers is doing so not only for himself but for future presidents. So if Mitt Romney had become president, and at some point there will be a future Republican president, that person, too, will have the power to order American citizens assassinated by the CIA with no due process, or imprisoned forever with no charges, or to be eavesdropped on and surveilled, or to have whistleblowers persecuted. And I would ask President Obama what safeguards he believes exist to prevent the abuse of those powers that he is now responsible for institutionalizing for future presidents as well as himself.
Now, of course, the Obama administration would say that extrajudicial assassinations have yielded results, crippling the command of al-Qaeda. If we set aside the civil liberties issues, I know that's hard because that's your thing, is this arguably been an effective policy?
No, absolutely not. And I'll tell you why. One of the questions that never gets asked whenever the topic of terrorism arises is why are there all these people in the world who want to do violence to the United States, who want to come to the United States and detonate bombs in Times Square or on American airplanes? And the answer, if you ask them why they do it, is extremely clear, which is it's because America continuously comes to our part of the world, to the Muslim world, and kills our men, women, and children, and we believe there's no other alternative. And so the constant aggression and killing people in that part of the world is exactly what exacerbates the risk of terrorism, not solves it. I don't think it's been effective at all. I think it's been incredibly counterproductive.
We're at 206-543-5869. If you got a question or a comment for Glenn Greenwald, 800-289-5869, or write to us, conversation@kuow.org. We've got Dusty on the line from Port Townsend. Dusty, good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm doing good. How are you?
Good. What's your question for Glenn Greenwald?
My question is, you're demonizing the president for exercising the power to kill or capture in other countries who are planning and plotting to kill Americans, and also Americans who joined al-Qaeda.
You know, Dusty, there's a terrible line there, but I think the gist of what Dusty wants to find out is, like, what would you do if you think that the president's policy is ill-advised? What do you think should be done?
Well, look at the premise of the caller's statement. He's assuming that the people that President Obama is killing and imprisoning are quote-unquote terrorists plotting attacks on the United States, when in fact that caller and nobody else has any idea whether or not that's true. All we know is that the administration claims that it's the case. But over the past 10 years, many claims that the administration has made, both the Bush and the Obama administrations, about who is a terrorist have turned out to be completely false. The essence of our system of government is that if the government has evidence that somebody is engaged in wrongdoing, plotting attacks on the United States is a crime, it's an international crime, it's a domestic crime, especially for a U.S. citizen, what you do is you go and show that evidence to a court. You get them indicted. You then extradite them. You put them on trial. You give them an opportunity to have due process. And only once you've convicted them of the crime and proven their guilt, only then do you punish them. You do not punish people, and you do not kill and execute people simply on the say-so of the president, unchecked by any judicial tribunal. This is just completely basic. And the fact that so many people think the way the caller did does, I think, shows just how transformative the Obama presidency has been in convincing people that these kinds of unchecked powers are now acceptable in the United States.
Would following due process and civil liberties make us as safe or safer from these attacks?
Well, I mean, President Obama himself, when he was in the Senate, constantly talked about how it's not a dichotomy between living under the rule of law and the Constitution and being safe. That actually, when you show the world that you treat people with justice and that you adhere to your own principles, then you become a safer country because the hatred that people have to the United States is lessened and your credibility in the world is increased.
You've talked about the use of the word terrorism, or what you would say is misuse of the word terrorism. You also say the word militant is something that's kind of tossed casually out there. Why?
Well, one of the things that happens in American media discourse is anytime an American bomb detonates by a drone or a missile or any other means, the government will claim that everybody killed is a quote-unquote militant, and the media will then parrot that without much skepticism. As it turns out, it's often the case, the people who are being killed are complete civilians, their children, their women, their innocent men who have never been involved in any militancy. But the word itself is propagandistic because we know, thanks to a New York Times expose 3 months ago that talked about the Obama kill list, that the Obama administration has formally adopted a new definition of militant that says that any military age male, meaning 18 to 55, in a strike zone is presumed to be a militant unless evidence is presented after their death that they're innocent. So the word militant essentially essentially means any Muslim male who the United States ends up killing. It is by definition a propagandistic term that is designed to mislead people into thinking that we're not actually killing anybody innocent, but only Muslims who deserve it.
You know, your critics say that it's impossible to tell a lot of times in these drone strikes who's being killed. It's a matter of debate. We don't know if they're innocent civilians. We don't know if they're people who are actually militants.
Well, that's correct in many instances, which is one reason why you don't vest the power to determine life and death in one individual, in one politician, without having some external check. But there are many documented cases where journalists, activists, and others have been able to go into Waziristan and into the federally administered tribal areas of Pakistan. We know for certain that in Yemen, lots of drone strikes have slaughtered children by the dozens, cluster bombs and drone strikes. And so there are lots of documented cases, even though there's debate about the numbers, where all kinds of innocent children have had their lives extinguished. Innocent Muslims have had their lives extinguished by attacks ordered by President Obama.
Little left turn here. I don't know if you heard about it, but the Seattle Police Department would like to deploy drones, not to bomb people or necessarily send fire down upon them, but some drones that would be in the air for 10 minutes. They say they want to use them for surveillance. They say the operator would always be able to see it. Should we be concerned about that?
Absolutely. I mean, one of the problems with civil liberties assaults when you justify them because they're only being directed at other people in other places is they always inevitably spread beyond their original application. And the threat of drones to privacy, even if you assume that drones won't be armed over the United States, and I think eventually they will be, even if you assume it's just surveillance drones, the capability of surveillance drones to stay in the air for much longer than any other type of surveillance instrument, such as a helicopter, even a satellite, to follow and move with the Earth's rotation, they're incredibly cheap, which means you can deploy huge numbers of them. It enables a ubiquitous surveillance state that currently does not exist in terms of technological capability with very little regulation.
But the Seattle police says these will only be up for 10 minutes. They only have battery life for 10 minutes.
I'm sure that in the first instance, that is the case to make people comfortable, and then it'll be a half an hour, and then it'll be 5 days, and then it'll be permanent. That's how the nature of these powers work. If you believe the Seattle police can be trusted to have hovering drones surveilling whomever they want, why only have them up for 30 minutes? Why not have them up continuously? And that's clearly the direction into which this is headed.
And the Seattle police have suggested, you know, you'll be able to get a hold of those pictures and those videotapes. You'll be able to see what we're doing to know that we're not misusing this.
And then the question becomes, looking at the history of federal, state, and local police in the United States, do you believe that this power won't be abused? And I think any person who studies and is familiar with the recent history of the militarization of the police force in the United States would be very wary of empowering local police forces to engage in that level of surveillance.
Glenn Greenwald is my guest. He's been writing vociferously about the question of civil liberties and U.S. national security. We've been talking about that. Maybe you'd like to join in the conversation. It's 206-543-5869. Maybe you've read his books, which include With Liberty and Justice for Some, How the Law is Used to Destroy Equality and Protect the Powerful. Maybe you follow him on his Twitter feed. 100,000 people do. It's at G. Greenwald. We're going to go right to the phones. We have Demba on the line who's giving us a call today from Bellevue with a question. Demba, good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm good, Glenn. How are you?
Very well, thank you. Do you have a question for Glenn?
Yes, I do. In fact, I have a question and a comment. And my comment is that, in fact, I have, you know, President Obama is going after the bad guys in these places. Obviously, there are you know, other casualties. But, you know, these Muslim guys, I'm a Muslim. I'm heading to the Jummah right now. And these people go about killing their own people. They don't care if it's America goes after them or not. They're blowing their own babies' heads, you know, and their own people. Either we go there or not. So President Obama is waging an effective war against these people, and we need to eliminate them because they shouldn't be bulked out with other Muslims. My question is, why does the civil liberties of these people matter when the other kids and other babies and women's civil liberties are not being discussed in detail?
Anyone will get to Glenn on that. Where are you from, Demba?
I'm from Gambia, West Africa.
Thank you very much for calling. Let's hear what Glenn Greenwald has to say.
Well, it's the same issue. You know, if President Obama genuinely believes that these people who he's killing and ordering imprisoned are actually guilty of anything, he could easily present evidence to a court that that's true. But the worst part of what the caller is saying is simply ignoring the fact that large numbers of people who are being killed by these strikes are clearly innocent of all wrongdoing. They're children, they're women, and they're lots of innocent men. And so to pretend that everyone that President Obama is killing is some bad guy is very pleasing and nice to tell yourself, but it's completely false if you simply look at the basic evidence.
Demba, thanks a lot for your phone call. You wrote today, I believe, it was about a CNN report that Iranian warplanes fired on a U.S. drone aircraft, and you used that as a way to illustrate what you say is the U.S. media's willingness to accept Pentagon claims, but it also has a tendency to bolster animosity towards Iran. Could you expand upon that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's widely accepted and understood that the greatest media failure of perhaps all of American history, but certainly our generation, was the run-up to the Iraq War, in which American media outlets almost unanimously, mindlessly repeated the claims of the Bush administration about Saddam's nuclear program, his alliance with al-Qaeda, all of the other claims made to justify animosity towards Iraq and the need to go and attack them. Many of those turned out to be totally false. And the failure was the media simply repeated them rather than investigating them and expressing skepticism toward them. You see the same thing happening constantly now with Iran. And in particular, I looked at this incident where Iran, according to the U.S. military, shot down a U.S. drone. The U.S. military came out and said that this drone was basically just minding its own business. It was unarmed, and it was, quote unquote, just simply east of Kuwait in international airspace. Of course, east of Kuwait happens to be Iran. There are lots of instances where U.S. drones have entered Iranian airspace, and yet CNN simply reported this based exclusively on what the U.S. government had claimed without even including claims of Iran, who ultimately said that, in fact, the drone was inside of Iranian airspace, which would mean they were justified on self-defense grounds in shooting it down exactly the way that the U.S. would shoot down any Iranian drone that got anywhere near the U.S., U.S. airspace, let alone entered it. And this action, this practice of simply repeating what U.S. government officials say without any skepticism expressed, without any attempt to investigate or present the other side, is a very menacing one. It's what led to the Iraq War, and I think you see it very pervasive still in media behavior.
Well, of course, there were the accusations that Iraq was pursuing weapons of mass destruction, and now we're hearing that Iran is pursuing a nuclear program which would result in a nuclear weapon. Are we credulous to believe those claims, not only from the U.S. government, but from other governments?
Right. I mean, you know, if you look at what even Israeli government officials say, they will constantly say that Iran has actually made no decision about whether or not it will take what everybody agrees is its legitimate nuclear energy program and try and convert it into a nuclear weapon. But I think the broader question to ask is, why would Iran want nuclear weapons? And I think the answer pretty clearly is, aside from the fact that Israel has a huge stockpile of nuclear weapons, is the fact that Iran looks at what has happened to countries that don't have nuclear weapons, that gave up their nuclear weapon research, like Iraq or Libya, and compares that to countries that do have nuclear weapons, such as North Korea or Israel, and sees the vastly different treatment that a country receives when they have nuclear weapons. The United States has basically sent out the signal that you ought to have nuclear weapons, because if you don't, there's a good chance we will invade you, kill your leaders, and occupy your country.
Do we want another North Korea, which is starving its citizens and arguably committing tremendous human rights abuses, in part because they have a nuclear weapon and people are afraid to act?
Well, I mean, interestingly, there's no real comparison between the Iranian government and the North Koreans. Aside from the fact that the Iranian president is elected, the Iranians have long been a integrated part of the international community. They have allies in Russia and China and Latin America, people with whom they do lots of business. They haven't invaded other countries in centuries, unlike the United States and Israel, which invades countries fairly frequently. And to the extent Iranians are suffering and starving, it's because of the sanctions regime that's currently being imposed by the United States and its allies on the Iranians, and not because of anything the Iranian government itself is doing. So I think, you know, I think in general, nuclear proliferation is a bad idea. You want fewer countries to have nuclear weapons rather than more. But at the same time, you have to look at the incentives that are being created as to why a country like Iran would pursue nuclear weapons, even at the costs that are being imposed on them. And the answer is because in a world where you can be invaded and have your government changed and your government leaders killed, you create the incentive for countries to want to acquire nuclear weapons as a means of protecting themselves against that sort of aggression. And I think the real issue to stopping nuclear proliferation is to take out the incentive that countries have to acquire them.
Got a question for Glenn Greenwald, 206-543-5869. Matt's listening to us today in the Magnolia neighborhood. Matt, good afternoon. Thanks for calling. What's your question?
Hi. Yeah, it's a couple points back now, but I was wondering what the guests thought of the net effect on Obama's effectiveness to pass any progressive or liberal legislation in the future if he pulled out entirely militaristically from the Middle East.
Are you thinking of anything in particular you think he might be able to accomplish if he did that?
Well, as far as, you know, if he fell out of favor completely from people who view the Middle East as a severe, like, military threat, which, you know, might not be rational, but pervasive in the political community, would he be able to push anything through, get any support from either partisan or nonpartisan government?
Yeah. Okay, Glenn.
Yeah, I would answer that in a few ways. First of all, he had lots of military aggression in the first term. I don't really think he had all that much progressive legislation that he pursued. So I don't really see this link. But I would say
the Affordable Care Act.
I mean, you could. I mean, if you're going to put something in his column, you would put that. There's an argument about whether requiring people to buy from the private health insurance industry with no public component is really progressive. It was pioneered by the Heritage Institute Foundation. But give him that. But there's not like a panoply of liberal, progressive, legislative achievements in his column. But if you look at polling, the American citizenry is actually quite tired of constant militarism and aggression and interference in the Muslim world. There really are isolationist sentiments that are shared by the majority of Americans, a desire to spend less on military, to not be as involved in other countries' internal affairs as we are, certainly to fight fewer wars. But I think the caller raises an interesting question, which is the link between foreign policy and militarism and domestic policy. One of the reasons why progressive legislation is impossible is because so much money is spent on this bulging military. I mean, we spend almost more than the entire world combined on our military. Every dollar spent by the rest of the world, every other country, is almost less than the amount total that the United States spends on its military. And progressive legislation, progressive government policies become impossible when that amount of money is being spent toward this type of imperial aggression.
You know, there's a story out today from NPR about the impact of the fiscal cliff. And one of the factoids pulled out was that cutting to the military is the least effective thing to do when it comes to the overall economy. There seems to be also an economic benefit to the size of the military economy.
Well, the military obviously employs lots of people. When you buy lots of fighter jets, it helps Boeing and General Dynamics and other American corporations. This has always been the case. At the same time, there are lots of more effective ways to improve your economy than by buying bombs and sending people overseas in fighter jets.
Let's go to Kirkland. We have Lewis on the line who's got a question for my guest, Glenn Greenwald. Go ahead, Lewis.
Yeah, my question was, is Osama bin Laden right or are you right? Osama bin Laden had many years to address the world as what his concerns were, and he stated emphatically that a radical fundamentalist Muslims like himself were practicing Islam just as Muhammad did, and he would be rewarded with 72 wives and eternal life in paradise if he were to die fighting us in a war. Now, that's a pretty strong incentive to a young man. I think it's a lot stronger incentive than be all that you can be. And I think that we have to take that in consideration, that who stands in the way of this vision of the radical fundamentalist Muslims are two essential points, the United States and being the strongest military power, and Israel, a Jewish state right in the middle of the Middle East, a Jewish state which did not exist for 2,000 years, and all of a sudden, boom, it's here. This shows Muhammad to be a false prophet, which is a profound disquieting and creates a great disequilibrium in the mind of a Muslim fundamentalist.
Lewis, thanks for your phone call. So your question, the United States and Israel, according to you, the essential powers to kind of maintaining the world as we would like to see it.
Well, interestingly, I mean, the caller raised what Osama bin Laden has said. What he actually said when he issued his first fatwa against the United States in 1998 was that there were three grievances that the Muslim world had against the United States. One was that the U.S. had killed 500,000 children in Iraq through its sanctions regime that it had imposed. The second was that by constantly supporting Israel, it was enabling lots of aggression against Muslims in that part of the world. And then the third was occupation of holy lands in Saudi Arabia and others, and thus desecrating the Muslim religion. These grievances are always linked to U.S. foreign policy. And so the question becomes, do we eliminate Islamic radicalism by simply trying to kill as many people as we possibly can in the hope that one day we'll eradicate the people who hate us, which only increases the hatred more? Or do we start to think about what it is that we're doing in the world that causes so many people to have animosity toward us? And to me, the second approach seems not only the more ethical one, though it is the more ethical one, but also the much more effective one.
You know, some people would say, we're pretty well off based on the policy, the way that it has gone in terms of safety. Do you buy that?
I think that if you look at, for example, why it is that Al-Qaeda decided not to attack Peru or Sweden or South Africa or Cambodia, but decided instead to attack the United States, you see that our policies of trying to interfere in and control and prop up dictators in the Muslim world is what causes the anti-American sentiment that leads to terrorism. Even the Pentagon says that. So I think these policies have not been effective in making us safe. I think, if anything, the reason we're vulnerable to terrorism to the extent we are is precisely because of these policies.
Let's go to Maggie. She's listening to us up on First Hill this afternoon. Maggie, what's your question for Glenn Greenwald?
Well, I just wanted to say really quickly, Mr. Greenwald, that I have no end of respect for you. I've followed your work for years. But my question is, how can we get President Obama to reverse all the extrajudicial killing that he's authorized?
Yeah, I mean, it's a great question, and thanks for that. You know, I think that the important thing is that in a political system that is democratic in nature, people have the power to pressure their leaders to act in accordance with their values and to demand that they promise to fulfill their promises. And I think one of the reasons President Obama was able to get away with as much as he did in his first term was because American progressives largely stopped caring about the things they claimed to care about when George Bush was in office in pursuit of partisan ends. And I think it's incredibly important that citizens look at themselves first and foremost as citizens and political leaders as public servants and think about ways to hold them accountable and to pressure them to do the right thing rather than to think about how to venerate them or support them or empower them.
Maggie, thanks a lot for your call. Let's hear from Ian, who's giving us a call this afternoon to talk to Glenn Greenwald. Ian, go right ahead.
Hi there. I was just kind of curious about your opinion on the TSA and their powers, including starting to swab people's drinks and lobbies of airports.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things about this whole security theater, and of course it's bizarre that you can get on a train or enter a crowded shopping mall without any security measures of any kind, and only these things exist for airports, is to realize that it's not only about sort of contriving the appearance of security, it's also an incredibly lucrative industry. The technology that is developed and then sold to the government, the all kinds of companies that are employed to do these things, much of this is simply driven by profit, by corporation, by lobbyists in Washington. The TSA is becoming incredibly invasive. And one of the problems is that it just starts to normalize the kinds of invasiveness that we just become accustomed to. And it starts to seep into other areas. It's a way that we psychologically give up more and more of our expectations of privacy.
And Kevin, in the Greenwood neighborhood, you have a question for Glenn Greenwald?
Yes, I do. Thank you. What do you make of the sometimes mentioned claim that it's not really our foreign policy issue that's causing the problem in the Middle East, but rather the imperial or domination goals of Islamic radicals, or in that if we were to merely roll back our foreign policy, they would merely expand to fill the void and then continue to expand based on their religious worldview.
Thanks for your question, Kevin.
I mean, I have no doubt that, you know, certain of the most radical elements in that faction are ones who think that way, who want to reinstitute a caliphate and the like. But the reason that Al-Qaeda and similar factions have been successful to the extent they have is they've been able to sustain widespread, pervasive, popular support in the countries where they operate. And the reason for that is the animosity toward the United States as a result of the violence and aggression that we bring. And again, I would urge you to look at the statements of people who have been convicted of terrorist conspiracies in the United States to detonate the bomb in Times Square, to detonate the bomb in the New York subway. There are lots of court proceedings where they are asked, how is it that you could possibly justify detonating a bomb that would kill children and other innocent people? And invariably, their answer is not, well, we want to reestablish Islamic dominance. Their answer is, look at what your government does in our countries and the way that you kill people and kill our children. And this is the only option that we have to stop you from doing that.
Yesterday, the lawyer for Bradley Manning, the Army private accused of leaking classified information to WikiLeaks, said that he'd offered he'd plead guilty to lesser charges. It's been a case you've been focused on. Your reaction to that news?
Well, one of the most disturbing parts of the Bradley Manning prosecution is that one of the things they've charged him with is aiding and abetting the enemy, and meaning Al-Qaeda. And the theory there is that if you disclose information of a classified nature, even if you have no intent to benefit Al-Qaeda or give it to them directly, that you could be charged with that crime. It's a capital offense. You can be killed for it, although they're not seeking the death penalty. They're seeking life imprisonment. And so this is an effort to say, look, to the extent Bradley Manning committed any crime, it was really simply the unauthorized disclosure of classified information. We're willing to admit that he did that and then have the proceeding focus on whether he had any intent to actually aid al-Qaeda or other enemies of the United States, because that's the true dubious aspect of the prosecution theory.
Glenn Greenwald, you could read him at The Guardian. You can also check out his books. You can also read him at G. Greenwald on Twitter. Well, we didn't even have a chance to talk about your Twitter profile that says you're a dog and animal fanatic. Maybe
we'll come back and do that. I'd love to.
We'll talk about dogs and animals later on. Thanks a lot for being with us, Glenn.
Thank you, Tommy.
David Hyde produces The Conversation with Arwin Nix. We get production help from Andy Hurst, who's also our engineer, from KUOW 94.9 Seattle. I'm Ross Reynolds.